If my brother has it, if my brother has it, I think we're shit smaller right now, but we're really like close.
All right, everybody. You have your Chapter 8 assignment that's due tonight. So most of you have finished it, but if not, make sure it's in tonight. I've decided to push back the Chapter 9 assignment. So, shucks, right? We're still having the exam on Monday, but we're not going to totally finish Chapter 9 today. We'll have a little bit of it next week. I'll do like I've done before, where I will put a little indicator, a little note within the assignment for what problems will cover material that's on this upcoming exam. So it is to your benefit to make sure you can practice and be proficient at at least the first three quarters or whatever of the Chapter 9 assignment that's up. So, go ahead.
Is there
going to
be a master in chemistry side of Chapter
9? Yes, but it will be optional. Okay. It will not be for points. It will just be for practice.
For Chapter 10.
Chapter 10, yep. So I'll have it up. It'll have everything you need there for practice for the types of problems, but it will not count. Yep, no.
Nice.
Just for practice.
Do you think
it replaced
a bad assignment?
What's that?
Could it, replace? Yeah. And we didn't go to Chapter 10. Could it, replace your worst?
Hmm.
You think about it.
I may be open to that.
I like that.
I'll consider it. Okay. If that's the case, I'll have to make the Chapter 10 one a little harder.
I like the extra credit part better.
It's not going to be for extra credit. Material that is part of our actual course, things that you really should be doing anyway, is not going to be extra credit. So we've got our exam on Monday. Make sure you don't forget about those last two sections of Chapter 6. So there will be questions on Hess's law and some sort of calculation for enthalpy of formation, that sort of stuff. So those last couple of sections in Chapter 6 will be covered on the third exam, so go back and make sure you review those. Then it'll cover up through the material that we get through today in Chapter 9. Monday is the last day of experimentation for the lab project, so I do expect to see some experimentation actually happening. So, you can be analyzing your data or something like that, but at least do one more trial or something to replace one of the bad trials or something like that. So, I don't think it's acceptable to just use that time to that last one to the whole time be just writing or analyzing or something. So, set something up, do at least some kind of experiment. The lab is also open this afternoon today. So if you want to go in there at least until 4:30 today, the lab is available if you need to get something taken care of. Oh, John?
Two quick questions.
Yeah.
What time is the lab open today? Is that
3:20 or? Today, let's see here. There's technically a class in there. There's technically class in there until 3:10, but it's 10:20, and I think it's a short experiment, so I think they'll be mostly done. So I'll be over there. You can check with me anyway to see if it's... So probably won't be immediately after class. There'll still be some 10:20 students working in there, but as soon as it starts clearing out and there's an empty table, you can get in there. So...
And then the other question is with the final exam, you said it was standardized and that obviously it's normed.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to get a hold of the data on how it's normed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have that handout. I can post that.
Okay.
Yeah, I have that sheet. There's a sheet that converts your raw score into the percentage. So I've got that somewhere. Not in the one that I posted, I believe. This is okay. Okay, so here's the one I posted. It has a list of topics, has equations that you should know, strategies, yeah. Is this it? This might be out. So I will post this. And our final's out of 150 points. So to get a 90% on the exam, right, to get 91% on the exam, you need 51 out of 70.
Okay.
So there's 70 questions. If you get 51 correct, you'll get 91%. To get a passing grade, so to get 70 on the exam, you need 38 out of 70 questions. To get a 60% on the exam, which is probably minimum to get a C in the course, you would need at least 16 out of 70. But the exam is difficult. Right? You're not going to automatically get 16 out of 70 by not trying. So that's good. Typically our classes have averaged around the 50th percentile, which is where? Percentile. Here we go. In here. Yeah, right in this range. The 50th percentile, which means average for the country, is about 40, 41 out of 70, and that translates to a 75% on the exam, which has been typical of the averages of our exams so far. So, okay, but I'll still post this. Okay. All right, other questions? Well, let me see here. Well, that was the wrong. Oh, yeah. These were the announcements. I meant. Chapter 9, now due Friday, December 11. I'll mark the questions that are exam 32. So. All right. The start of this chapter was on ionic bonding. So we drew Lewis dot structures of atoms and showed how they were converted into ions. Okay. We talked about lattice energy, that extra amount of energy that is given off when ions come together in an ionic lattice that way. So be familiar with those types of things. There are questions on each of those sorts of things on the Mastering Chemistry assignment. The rest of this chapter will be involved with covalent bonding. Covalent bonding is where a pair of shared electrons, where we have a pair of shared electrons between two non-metal atoms, usually. So with ionic bonding, we did not share electrons. What did we do?
Transferred.
Yeah, transferred. One gave an electron away and the other received it. Or if something had two electrons to give away, then two might receive it, or one might receive two, all depending on what was needed to make stable ions out of them. We're no longer talking about ions specifically when we're bonding here. Notice, though, we're talking about nonmetal atoms. When I have two atoms that make an ionic bond, what kinds of atoms are those? Metal and a nonmetal. Right? The metal will give electrons away, the nonmetal will accept electrons. But when we have both nonmetals, they share their electrons in order to become stable. Covalent bonding is what holds atoms together in a molecule. So having that sort of terminology is very important. There are no molecules in ionic compounds because the ions are just alternating in that big ionic lattice. They're just all stacked up. But when we have nonmetals that are covalently bonded, we have groups of atoms that make a molecule. So the entire substance is made of those molecules, which act as individual units themselves. So let's just take the simplest molecule there is, H2. Let's form H2 from two hydrogen atoms. So if I'm doing this like dot structures, what kind of dots would I draw next to just a neutral hydrogen atom? One. All right. Hydrogen has one dot. That's it. Its electron configuration is 1s1. Right? It's a single electron. So if I have a hydrogen atoms themselves are unstable. They don't exist for any extended period of time. What is it about this hydrogen that makes it unstable?
Half-filled shell.
Yep, half-filled shell. Right? N equals 1 is only half full. Shells, when shells are full or empty, that's when we get stability. So if I had a sample of hydrogen atoms, as soon as one hydrogen atom came within proximity of another hydrogen atom, they would move close to each other so that those two electrons would be shared in between the two hydrogen atoms. Okay? So if we just consider either one of these hydrogen atoms, like this one right here, now it has access to two electrons. It has access to its own and the one that was brought in from the other atom. So how many electrons does hydrogen need in order to become stable? Two, right? Because helium, the noble gas, has two electrons. So this is a way, without transferring electrons, without making any pluses or minuses, to sort of fool this hydrogen into thinking that it has a full shell. Okay? So each hydrogen has access to two electrons. Okay? They don't each own two electrons, okay? But those two are shared between them, so they each can see those two electrons. So the way we actually draw this is H with two H's with a single line in between them. The covalent bond, that we said here, is drawn as a line. That line contains two shared electrons. So never forget that. When we have a line connecting atoms, it's a pair of electrons that are shared between those. Right? So if we move on to a little bigger molecule, if I want to form water from two hydrogens and one oxygen, this will show us why water is H2O and not H3O or HO2 or something like that. Okay? In order for those atoms to become stable, H2O gives us that sort of arrangement. So if I have a hydrogen, if I have an oxygen, how many valence electrons does oxygen have? Six, right? One, two, three, four, five, six. I'll just draw them that way to be convenient. And the other hydrogen. What can happen is that oxygen can share with both of those hydrogens. Those two can be shared, and those two can be shared. And what ends up happening then is each of the hydrogens will have access to two electrons, just like they did up here. Okay? The oxygen then will have access to how many electrons when it shares with those hydrogens? It'll have access to eight. And what's special about eight valence electrons? Yeah, noble gases have eight valence electrons, so it becomes stable. What we end up with is so how come I have two lines and then two pairs of dots in that last structure? What do those four dots represent? The electrons on oxygen, but how are those electrons different from the other? Yeah, they're not part of the bond. They're just still on that oxygen. Okay? So those are unshared electrons. They're also known as lone pairs. Lone pairs are pairs of electrons that are not shared. They just remain on the atom that originally had them. Okay? But we have two shared pairs, so those are the covalent bonds. Make it a little more complicated. Oxygen atoms themselves are not stable. Right? You saw that, and I'm going to draw this just a little bit differently with that. Remember I said the arrangement of those dots, the direction of them, isn't quite as important, but I'll put them in sort of a little more convenient position. Oxygen atoms are not stable on their own. If I had a sample of oxygen atoms, they would quickly pair up and form O2 molecules. That's why oxygen is a diatomic element. It doesn't exist as lone atoms because these O atoms are not stable electronically. All one has to do is come up next to another oxygen atom. How are those two going to become stable?
Share two electrons.
Yeah, they're going to each share two of their electrons, right? Those two can be shared, as well as those two. We end up with four electrons that are shared between the oxygens. Okay. How am I going to draw that like I did these other ones up here? Yeah, we're going to make a double bond. So, two lines. Usually when we're drawing those structures, we'll spread the lone pairs out around them, but that's not critical. Okay? So, yeah, that's a double bond. So how many electrons are shared between those oxygens? Four, right? Each of those lines is a pair of electrons. Look at just one of these oxygens. Count up how many electrons it has access to. Well, it's got four of its own, but then how many shared electrons does it have access to? Four. So total, each oxygen has access to eight. Okay. N2 from two nitrogen atoms. Okay. Nitrogen has five valence electrons. So what kind of bond will form between two nitrogen atoms? A triple bond. That's right. Triple bond. So because the nitrogens had five of their own originally, it will share three of those five in order to form the triple bond between them so that each will have access to eight total. Okay. The octet rule still applies to these main group elements. What was the octet rule?
Eight.
Eight electrons is what they all want. Okay. So by covalently bonding, all of these have access to eight electrons. Hydrogen and helium, they only need two electrons to fill up the 1s subshell, right? So sometimes that's called the duet rule. But all the other main group elements tend to form compounds where they have eight electrons around them. In a little bigger molecule like this, we can check to make sure that all of those atoms' original valence electrons are represented in the structure of that molecule. So in C2H4, you know how many valence electrons carbon has, right? You know how many hydrogen has. How many does carbon have, just from the periodic table?
Two.
Two?
Four.
Four, yeah. 2s2, 2p2. Okay. So add them up. How many valence electrons total will be in this molecule? Did we get it? Carbon has four. I have two carbons in this molecule. Yeah, so from the carbons, eight plus four. What do you get? 12? Twelve valence electrons total in this molecule. If carbon has four of its own valence electrons, right? If carbon originally looks like that, how many covalent bonds does carbon need to form in order to get to eight? It needs to form four covalent bonds. Okay? If I have C2H4, I'll give you a hint by drawing where the hydrogens are. What kind of bonds does hydrogen always make?
Six.
Yeah, hydrogen can't make anything more than a single bond, because hydrogen can't hold any more than two electrons. Okay. Then, what's left over? What kind of bond has to be between those two carbons?
Double.
Okay. Has to be a double bond. So, in a little bit, we'll go through the specific rules in drawing complex Lewis structures. We'll have a foolproof way that'll do it. But in this structure, have I accounted for all 12 valence electrons? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. So, a proper Lewis structure of a molecule has to show all of the valence electrons. Okay? So, we'll come back to drawing structures like this. They'll get much more complicated pretty soon. But before we do that, let's talk about how bonds actually function, how covalent bonds actually work. It turns out that Lewis theory oversimplifies the behavior of shared electrons in many cases. When I drew those two dots between two atoms, it would suggest that those two are shared equally between those atoms. Okay? But, for example, in HF, where if I drew a simplified structure, okay, that suggests to us that the hydrogen has access to two. The fluorine has access to 8, but it suggests that those two shared are equally available to the hydrogen and fluorine, but that's not necessarily the case. There's a pretty simple experiment that can be done. HF is a gas. If I had a sample of HF gas in some sort of chamber like this with two metal plates, on either side of it, and if I applied an electric current to those metal plates, if we had an electrical potential between those two plates, so if I hooked up one electrode of a battery to one and, you know, plus to the one and minus to the other, what would happen would be that the HF molecules would align themselves within that electric field. Okay? A lot like how a compass aligns itself to the Earth's magnetic field. Or if you had a powerful electromagnet, several compasses would align immediately to that. Right? These HF molecules will all align themselves in a particular direction. Turns out there is a positive side and a negative side to an HF molecule. And I'll show you this little squiggle here in a moment. But look at the charge here. Here's the minus electrode, the plus side of the HF molecule aligns towards it, just like the north pole of a magnet aligns in a certain direction within a magnetic field. Okay. So that's evidence to us that the electrons within that bond are not evenly shared. If I show you this picture here, turns out it's called a polar covalent bond. If the little one here is the H and the bigger one is the F, this picture here, it's got a fancy name. It's an electrostatic potential map. But pretty much what it's showing is where more electrons are. Okay? On the red side, there is a larger population of electrons. Okay? On the blue side, there is a much smaller population of electrons. So it's called electron density. More electron density on that side, less on that side. That's why we were able to assign these sort of partial charges to the molecule. Make sure I don't define that later. No, so we'll define that right here. Because there's more electron density on the F side, we're going to assign what's called a partial negative charge. This Greek lowercase delta means partial. It's not a full minus charge like an ion would have. Fluorine would be F minus if we had given it an entirely new electron. It has a partial negative charge because those two electrons within here spend more time towards the fluorine than they do towards the hydrogen. If they were equally shared, we would not have that partial negative charge on the one end and the partial positive charge on the other end due to the lack of electrons. So that imbalance in the location of shared electrons. Remember, electrons, we draw them as dots to be convenient, but they don't exist in any one place at any one time. They're like a swarm of insects or something like that that happens to be more likely to be over the fluorine than closer to the hydrogen. Okay? Does that make sense? A polar covalent bond like that is an intermediate between the two types of bonds we've already considered. A pure covalent bond has electrons equally shared, and an ionic bond has electrons that were what? Is that outer? Transferred. So you see how a polar covalent bond is in between those? Equally shared means they have equal likelihoods to be on either side. There would be no partial charges on either side. If they are transferred, what kind of charges do we have? They're not partial charges anymore. They're total charges. They're full charges. Okay? It would be F minus. Or if it was an O, it could be O2 minus from getting two whole electrons.
So would O2 be an example of a pure covalent bond?
Absolutely. Let's draw one like that. Okay. There's no, I mean, at one instant in time, electrons might be on one side more than another, but the average of all circumstances, there's no bias for one of these elements or another. It turns out elements like fluorine pull those shared electrons towards it more. So there's no bias from those. The electrons are shared equally. This would be a pure covalent bond with no partial charges. So bonds that are symmetrical like that, where the same atom is connected to either side, they have to be shared equally. Because it's the same element. One will not pull more than the other. Those shared electrons. Okay? Ionic bonds were what we talked about before, like where I have an Na plus and a Cl minus, where because those are oppositely charged ions, they're attracted towards each other. Within the covalent bond, the attraction comes because these are electrons. They are equally attracted to the nuclei in both of those atoms. Okay? So if both of these atoms have the same nucleus, these electrons will be equally attracted. Okay? If we look at hydrogen and fluorine, what is present in the nucleus of hydrogen? One proton? What's present in the nucleus of fluorine? Yeah, lots of protons. So there's a stronger attraction between these negative electrons and the protons within that nucleus. So they'll be pulled more towards the fluorine than towards the hydrogen. So the way we quantify that is by electronegativity. It's the ability of an atom to attract electrons to itself in a chemical bond. So like those covalent bonds that we've shown, electronegativity shows how much they will be pulling those shared electrons. What do the orbitals look like? The covalent bond itself, if we have hydrogens, 1s, like that, turns out fluorine It has 1S and 2S, 2P2, right? 2P2 on there. And then the third 2P orbital that's only halfway full will actually overlap with that hydrogen. Right? So let's actually look at it like this. There's one electron in that hydrogen. This third orbital right there in the 2P has its own one electron, and the place where those overlap is the covalent bond. So covalent bonding comes from the overlap of orbitals in order for them to appear to be full.
So could that one electron from hydrogen go all the way over to the other side of the fluorine atom?
Yep. Once we talk in overlapped orbitals, now these two electrons will exist this entire space, right, between this orbital and that orbital.
Okay.
Right? They're available to move all throughout that. Because fluorine, as we'll see, is more electronegative, these two electrons will tend to spend more time over here than over here on the hydrogen. Okay, that's a good question. So this is a graphic of electronegativity on the periodic table. You can see it's a periodic trend. Okay? It moves smoothly in both directions on the periodic table. There are different scales of electronegativity. The Pauling scale is most commonly used, where 4 is the most electronegative. So fluorine, right here, is sort of the reference. It's the most electronegative of all the elements. Going either direction away from fluorine decreases electronegativity. So going across a period, it increases. So that's going towards fluorine. Going down a column, it decreases. Right? So we increase going that way, we decrease going down a column. Okay? But I think a little easier way to think of it is that fluorine is the most, and going any direction away from fluorine decreases that. So electronegativity, it's how much an atom pulls electrons towards it. Let's see if we can figure out why it is that the periodic trend is that way. And remember, we've talked about periodic trends going across a row and down a column so far. What happens as we go across a row? Electronegativity increases. What happens in those atoms? What happens as you go from carbon to nitrogen to oxygen to fluorine? What's changing? More electrons and more protons. Okay? Those electrons are all going into the same space, right? But we have more protons now. So why is it that fluorine is more electronegative than nitrogen or oxygen or carbon? What's that? More protons, which means what? It attracts the electrons towards it. Right? Coulomb's law says that the larger the magnitude of those opposite charges, the stronger they'll pull together. Okay? Now, why does electronegativity decrease as I go down a column? When I go down a column, what happens to the atoms? They get bigger. What do we add to an atom when I go down a column? We add a shell of electrons. Okay? So chlorine adds a shell, bromine adds another shell, iodine adds another shell. Okay? So we are adding more protons, okay, because we've added another whole row worth of protons to it. But those protons have that same number of electrons that's in between the shared electrons and the nucleus. Okay? So it sort of cancels out, right? Because I have another shell that's in the way, that's sort of blocking the nucleus from the pair of electrons that's being shared. So it's a couple of things that's happening. Distance is growing bigger. So Coulomb's law says as that radius increases, there's less of an attraction. Okay? But also, those additional shells in between are shielding the nucleus. Yeah, that way. So fluorine is sort of the perfect combination here. It has the most protons of those within its shell, essentially, of those within the same shell. Okay? But It has the fewest shells of all those that are like it. That make sense? So that's why fluorine is the best. Down here, those big, supposedly explosive alkali metals have the lowest electronegativities. It turns out things like this with electronegativities of one or less, they have absolutely really no desire to share electrons at all. They want to give their electrons away. They don't have any need for extra electrons. Okay? So the way we figure out whether a bond is pure covalent, polar covalent, or ionic, it comes from the difference, okay, of the two electronegativities. If you think of it like a tug of war, if you have two people that are evenly matched, then it's a stalemate. Okay? It doesn't go either direction. But if one is much stronger than the other, the stronger one gets the difference. Okay? If it's really close, if one is stronger but not by much, then it might, the rope or whatever might move a little bit in that direction. Okay? So we're talking about the difference, delta of electronegativities. Okay? So the general rule is that if the difference of electronegativity, right, delta En, so difference of electronegativity between those two atoms, if it's zero, like if it's two of the same atoms, right, chlorine and chlorine, same electronegativity, difference of zero, okay, but anywhere from 0 to 4, using that Pauling scale that we had on the last page, gives us a nonpolar covalent bond. So if I had, let's go back to our little scale here, if I have a CH bond, what is the difference in electronegativities between carbon and hydrogen according to this table? Yeah, can you guys read it? Hydrogen is 2.1, carbon is 2.5. So what kind of bond is this considered to be? Yeah, this is a pure covalent bond. Yes, carbon is slightly more electronegative, but for the purposes of our being able to classify bond types, this is going to be a pure covalent bond. We will not assign partial charges to either of the atoms in the CH bond. And that's going to be very important to us when we're drawing structures later on. So carbon and hydrogen essentially share those electrons equally between them. Okay. So let's look at these other examples. CLCl, delta 0, right? That's the same for any identical atoms, of course. Okay. In an HCl molecule, you can look at those numbers. Chlorine was 3.0. Hydrogen was 2.1. That gave us 0.9. Anywhere between 0.4 and 2, there is significant sharing that's happening, but it's not equal sharing. So we call that a polar covalent bond. Anything greater than 2, okay? And here, I'll actually, since this just only shows 0.4 that way, 0.4 is considered pure covalent. So over here, starting on this end, greater than. Yeah, let's do some proper inequalities. Let's make that a less than or equal to. And then let's make this a greater than. Yeah. Yeah. And with the 2, I'm not quite sure how that goes. I think you can probably go either way with that 2. But because of that special carbon-hydrogen relationship, 0.4 is considered equal sharing. Okay. Anything greater than 2 would definitely be ionic. So 2.1 There is not enough similarity, there's not enough similarity in those electronegativities for electrons to be shared to any extent. Okay? Chlorine pulls way too hard. Sodium really doesn't want to pull very much at all. So big difference, just like a tug of war. You've got a big person and a real wimpy person. There won't be any contest with the tug of war. Okay? So just think of it that way. You do not need to memorize any electronegativity values. If you're ever asked to do anything quantitative with that, some values could be given for you. Or if all you need to do is figure out whether a bond is polar or not, you can consider that what we've talked about before still pretty much stands. How did we define an ionic bond before this chart? Metal and a nonmetal, right? Staircase. It's actually not there, it's one over. Right. The staircase there separates the metals from the nonmetals. And the reason we have that rule in the first place is that typically going across that staircase, especially with the common ion-forming nonmetals up here versus any other metal, the electronegativity difference will be great enough that it's considered an ionic bond. So calling it metal and nonmetal is ionic typically works. Okay? If it's a case where it's on an exam and you're not provided with any electronegativity values, it's safe to assume that metals and nonmetals will form ionic bonds together. Okay? Nonmetals together will form covalent bonds. Okay? They all have electronegativity similar enough to stay within at least the polar covalent range. There are cases, and we won't talk about those in this course, but look at something like the carbon-ruthenium bond or the carbon-palladium bond, things like that. Carbon forms covalent bonds with certain metals, especially these ones right in here. They're close enough in their electronegativities. So it's a branch of chemistry called organometallic chemistry. Organic chemistry involves carbon, but where carbon is bonded to metals, it becomes organometallic. So we don't deal with that at all in this course. Unless you're given actual numbers, it's safe to assume that any bond with carbon and, we don't really make ions too much with carbon because it's so electronegative. It's so not electronegative. But these other ion-forming ones, O minus, F minus, right? Very safe to assume that these pull strong enough to take electrons away from most of the metals.
Why does the transition metals have like a peak?
Why does it have a hump in it like that? It has to do something with the, and I'm not an inorganic chemist, so I don't remember this fully, but it has something to do with the way that the electrons are arranged within the D subshell. It's a little more complicated than just the five boxes and the ups and the downs. There are actually sort of two types of D orbitals that can sort of split apart. So the ones in the middle correspond to sort of one arrangement that's favored, and the ones on the edges are sort of a different arrangement. It's something like that, but it's been a long time since I took inorganic chemistry to remember that. Okay. So within the main group, the trend is very clear. Yeah. Every single column, it goes down. Every single row, going that way, it goes down. So, we had a question down here on the bottom. Which molecule is more polar, HF or CLF? You could probably make an estimation just based on position in the periodic table. Two elements that are next to each other will typically, what can you probably say about their electronegativities if they're just right next to each other on the periodic table? Yeah, they're going to be pretty similar. They'll certainly be more similar than one here versus one that's way across the periodic table. So just based on proximity, which one would you think is more polar? Yeah. For a polar bond, you want them to be far apart. You want there to be a greater difference. So just based on that, you could You could figure that out. But to verify it, right? 2.1 and 4.0, 3.0 and 4.0. Both would be considered what kind of bond? Both are polar covalent bonds. Okay? HF is much more polar than the CLF. We indicated partial charges, partial plus, partial minus. The partial negative goes on the more electronegative atom. Right? Makes sense. The one that pulls more electrons to it will have more of a negative charge. Okay? But it's a partial charge. It's not a full charge. Yeah? The other way to indicate that is what's called a dipole arrow. It just points to the more electronegative atom and then has a little crossbar on the plus side. It's called a dipole moment. Arrow points to the more electronegative atom. Right. So that dipole moment arrow means the exact same thing as those two partial charges. It's just more convenient to draw, especially when you have multiple polar covalent bonds within a molecule. You can draw dipole moments for each of those bonds. Okay? Clear on this so far? All right. So we're going to put that on the off to the side for just a moment. We're going to draw some Lewis structures of a little more complicated molecular compounds now. Okay? So for really, it gets to be very complicated molecules sometimes, it turns out. We've got these ones that have just three or four atoms in them for us to start with. That'll be the extent usually to which we'll have to draw structures of totally from scratch. If it's much bigger than that, you'll usually get some help. But for molecules like this, we can go through these four rules and we can be fairly confident that we have drawn a proper Lewis structure. Okay? With all the bonds in the right places and so on. So let's make a skeleton structure, okay? Connecting atoms with single bonds. Remember, hydrogens are always terminal. What does terminal mean? It's going to die on the end, right? So hydrogen. Why can hydrogens only be on the end of molecules? Yeah, they have one electron to share, so they can only be connected to one thing. That's it. So never put hydrogens in the middle of a molecule, not in this class anyway. More electronegative atoms also tend to be terminal, it turns out. Okay? So more electropositive atoms tend to be in the center of the atom. That's not 100%. We'll have a rule on the next slide that'll help us figure that out. Okay? But what would you guess would be the central atom in CH2O then, using that rule of thumb?
Oxygen?
More electronegative atoms tend to be terminal. Yeah. The second row goes boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine. Right. So just start with that atom in the middle. What about HCN? What's in the middle? What do you think? Carbon? Yeah? Okay. What do I say to do? Connect atoms with single bonds. So let's just start with single bonds. Just spread the other atoms out around. That's one way to start. Okay. With simple molecules, a lot of times you can sort of figure out in your head what kind of bonds need to form. But as they get more complex, it's more important that we have our structure here. Okay? So what I want you guys to do is calculate the total number of valence electrons for the whole molecules, like we've just done, okay? And then use dots to draw in those remaining valence electrons. Right? We've already shown some of the valence electrons in the structures that we have there. Okay? Use dots to draw in the remaining valence electrons, but don't show more electrons than our totals actually show. Okay? So calculate the totals. Right? You know how many valence electrons carbon has, nitrogen has, oxygen has. Carbon has how many? Valence electrons, sorry. 4. Oxygen has 6. Nitrogen has 5. What do you guys get for total in CH2O?
12.
12? Anybody else get 12? 4. 2 hydrogens. 6. What do you get for HCN? 5. Start with your skeleton structures. How many dots should I, how many electrons do I have yet to show from the skeleton structure here of CH2O? I have 6 to show, right? Because I have 6 already drawn. Okay? Remember, each of these is a pair. Okay? So draw 6 electrons, draw 3 pairs somewhere. Can they go on the hydrogens? No. Why not? Hydrogens already are full. Okay? So, some may say that you draw them around the outside atoms first, but I don't think it matters. Put them somewhere, but fill octets. Okay? Don't exceed octets. Right? So you can't put all 6 dots on carbon. Right? You could put all 6 dots on oxygen if you wanted to. What about HCN? How many dots do you have to draw? 6. Okay. Now, look at your structures. I haven't drawn any dots on mine yet. I want you to look at what you did. Do all of your atoms have octets that should have octets? Hydrogen doesn't get an octet, but that doesn't count. Do your carbons and oxygens and carbons and nitrogens, do all those have octets? Remember, you can't draw more dots than you're allowed. What you do is you make double or triple bonds if any atoms lack an octet. So when you make a double bond, you take 2 of the dots that you have, and instead of those just being dots, you make them into an additional covalent bond. Let me give you an example. Let's pretend I put my 6 dots on the oxygen there. What is the octet problem with my structure here?
Carbon.
Carbon is short of its octet. So what could I do to remedy that situation? I could make a double bond, okay? But by making a double bond, I can't just do that. I have to get rid of one of those pairs. Okay? So one way of imagining doing it is taking a pair of electrons and moving it from an atom to the bond, like that. Okay? Just taking a pair, right, where there were originally 2 electrons here, now I'll bring those in and make 4 electrons. Okay? Same thing with your HCN. So, we did this one together, pretty much. In your final structure for HCN, what kind of bond is between the H and the C? Between the H and the C. Is it a single bond? Can it be a double bond? Why not? Because it's hydrogen?
Hydrogen's special.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Hydrogen It's just that 1s shell. It only gets two electrons, and that's it. It would be, there's no place for hydrogen to put any more electrons than that. Okay? All right. What kind of bond is between the C and the N in this molecule? Yeah, a triple bond, that's right. Anything else in this structure? Two dots on the nitrogen. Okay. Hopefully you got that on your own. Let me go through a couple of the ways that you could have gotten to that point. Remember you said you needed six dots. If you did it that way, right? Carbon only has four electrons around it, so I'd have to bring in those and those, but that still leaves dots there. Okay. You could have also done, if I would have put them on carbon originally, can I put all six dots on carbon? Why not? Yeah, we can't exceed any octets. Now, nitrogen is short of its octet, so I would have to bring those in and those in for nitrogen to get its octet. Okay? So, two sort of rules kind of overarch here. And if you follow those rules, you'll have good, consistent structures. Okay? First, don't put more dots in than your total actually allows for. Okay? If you're lazy with that, you might start making something like this. We've got all the octets filled, right? What's wrong with that structure? Yeah, too many electrons. Okay. If you got lazy with that on this one, it might look like this. And I see structures like this on every exam, right? There are only 10 valence electrons in that structure. Okay? Students don't like counting up valence electrons. It's something that in my experience, students don't like doing, but you have to do that. Otherwise, you run the risk of making a nonsense structure like this that has way too many more electrons than what those atoms originally had. Remember, those atoms originally had a certain number of valence electrons of their own. When they come together, a certain number are shared, some are not shared, but we can't just make up as many electrons as we want. Okay. So, make sure the number of electrons is correct, then make sure octet rule is satisfied. The problem with this original green structure here was what?
Carbon
only had six electrons around it, so carbon was not stable yet. Okay. Carbon had an incomplete shell of electrons. So, oxygen, while it had an octet, it had a pair that was available to be shared. So oxygen still has access to the same number, but now it's sharing more of its electrons. Okay? So that seems like a little more work for small molecules like this. And probably, in most cases, you'd probably be able to figure those two out just sort of in your head. Right? If you know how many bonds carbon tends to form, right, you'd be able to do that. But for more complicated structures, things that involve sulfur and phosphorus and silicon and things like that, where they don't have a set number of bonds, okay, it's actually important that you start with the actual number of electrons you're allowed and then start trying to make double bonds you need to, wherever you need to, in order to satisfy those octets. Okay? It's also helpful when we have polyatomic ions, like this. The only difference, right, this is phosphate, right, that's carbonate. The only difference is that we need to account for the charge by adding or removing electrons from the total. So phosphorus is 5, oxygen is 6, right, we have 4 oxygens. Then what do I have to do with the number of electrons here to account for this charge? What does 3 minus mean?
3 more electrons.
3 more electrons. Right? So do that same thing with carbon there. Okay? Take just a moment, get the right totals for each of those, then use the same sort of rules that we've used before, where you first put all the electrons in, then only if there's an octet that's not full do you reshare electrons. So try to get reasonable structures for those.
Let's just take a moment and see how far we get.
But add up the totals first, then double check to make sure your actual structures have that in. When you have several oxygens in a molecule, the oxygens are around the central atom. So we have some atoms and then some number of oxygens, but the oxygens are around the central atom. So, rule of thumb. You have skeleton structure, and then you add in however many dots you need to get to the total. Never draw any double ones or anything until after you've drawn all the dots. when you have a final structure that you're happy about, put square brackets around it and show the charge outside of the square brackets, just like we did with other ions. That just shows that that entire structure has three more electrons than the atoms themselves originally. So what was the total in phosphate? 32? Remember I told you to just start with single bonds. Okay. How many dots do you need to draw? Yeah, it should be 24 dots. If I have four places that can accept dots, how can I draw 24? Yeah. I just do six on each. Phosphorus is fine, right, because it has eight electrons around it originally. Everything has its octets, so the structure that we start with should have no double bonds. Okay? If we start with just single bonds, we're able to draw those 24 electrons in and fulfill all the octets. There's no need for any double bonds yet. Okay? And the other one, what'd you get for a total for carbonate here? So how many dots to start with? 2, 4, 6 shown already. 18. Okay. Done? No? What's wrong?
Carbon doesn't have eight.
Carbon doesn't have an octet. Alright. No? Why can't I do that? It's too many. Right? We had to stop at this because that's 24. Okay. That's common mistake number one that I see students make. Common mistake number two is starting to draw lots of double bonds before you have the dots drawn in. Okay. So be disciplined with yourself. Get a total. Get your total. Get all of your dots. Okay. That shows the entire structure. How do I fix this?
Move
2 electrons from any of those oxygens. Make a double bond. Now I have an octet. Okay. Are there any questions about doing that? Please practice that. Okay. Exam 3, you'll have to do something like this. Okay. Just quickly before we go, let's talk about resonance structures. We won't get to formal charge. We'll just stop at this page. But if I have Lewis structures that are different only by the location of electrons within the structure, those are called resonance structures. There are, in this one up here, there are two other real clear resonance structures. Any idea which ones they are? That's right. I just sort of randomly chose this top one. We could have made the double bonded to either one. So this carbonate structure is actually made up of three resonance structures. one with the double bond on top, and I draw a double-headed arrow to go between resonance structures. Draw the double bond over there. Unless I'm careful about how many electrons I'm putting on each one, the double bonded one only gets 2 electrons, and this whole thing is a 2- charge. Now, you might think that we have just this one molecule that's just turning around. Okay. That's not the case. The actual molecule is a combination of all of those. It's a blend of all of these. So the actual CO bonds, okay, within the structure are equivalent. Okay. And it's a little hard for us to visualize, but each bond is somewhere in between a single bond and a double bond. Okay? So if you imagine having all of those on top of each other and you sort of blurred them together, that's what the actual structure is. Okay? There is no one bond that's different from the other two. Okay? We just have these three as three ways of showing where those electrons could go, okay, if they were fully in any one of those places. Okay? So actual structure has 3 equal CO bonds. These are what are called 3 equal resonance contributors to the structure. Okay. So you may need to know a little something about resonance. It's easiest to envision when you have a choice as to where to make a double bond. Okay? That's our first, probably most simplest way of having resonance structures. Okay? So that's probably all we'll be responsible for. So if you have a choice, there will be resonance structures from each of those, but the actual molecule is a combination of those. It's like they'd all been blended together. Okay? So that's where we will stop.